No matter where you are, all eyes on the Middle East today. I'm David Brown with the Texas Standard. It's not just adults fearing this is an historic tipping point and worrying about the implications. One illustration, yesterday as I was driving carpool after a school play practice, a teenager in the car posed one of the most important questions of the moment with startling clarity. Are we at war? On one level, the answer is an obvious yes. U.S. and Israeli bombs are dropping on Iran, a theocratic supreme leader and several top officials killed. Iran and its proxies now lashing back with missiles against nearly a dozen neighboring countries in the region that did not want to get involved. And yet, there are no U.S. boots on the ground and no action from Congress authorizing any war, officials and analysts alike, characterizing events as a massive operation or military action. And of course, the characterization of these events taking on domestic political dimensions, too. Here to offer some clarity on what's happening and why, Jeremy Suri, historian and Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs, History and Public Policy at the University of Texas at Austin. Professor Suri, welcome back.
Good to be back with you, David.
Some mixed messaging from the White House about this decision to bomb Iran. There was that Friday night into Saturday morning. I believe it was actually the wee small hours of Saturday morning when we first saw the video that was posted on Truth Social. And then he had another statement on Sunday. What do you make of how the president is describing what the U.S. is engaged in here?
Well, the explanations have been all over the place. One explanation is that this is a response to the nuclear project that Iran has long had that we said we had destroyed months ago. Another argument is that this is a response to Iran's longstanding support for terrorism. And a third is that this is just a horrible regime and the world is a better place without it. But no cohesive explanation about why this is the moment to go to war and why this is the moment when America is under threat from Iran. Neither of those cases have been made.
You know, I've heard a lot of conversation over the weekend about the imminent danger. What was the imminent danger that prompted the U.S. to strike? Is that necessary to have that imminent danger when you've got a presence 47 years that has been calling for death to the United States, and then you've got intelligence, at least according to BBC and other reports, that you've got a meeting of the supreme leader in Iran with all of his military chiefs in one place, and this coming on the back of massive protests and massive killings of protesters, too. Isn't it true that Iran was at a particularly vulnerable point? And if one didn't strike now, when would that strike happen?
It's a great question, David. In fact, that's multiple questions in one.
Yeah.
The Constitution does not say when the United States should go to war. The president is commander in chief, but the Constitution presumes that if we decide to go to war, which is what you're describing, if we decide to eliminate a regime because we think that regime is odious for some reason, that the president will go to Congress to get authorization. The imminent danger argument is made by presidents when they undertake actions like this because they're saying they don't have time to go to Congress. But most of what you're describing, particularly about the regime's treatment of its own people, its support for terrorism overseas, these are things the Iranian regime has been doing for years. Maybe they are justification for going to war, but then the president would have to go to Congress, which he did not do. So the imminent danger argument is made because there's a claim, at least a legal claim, that this was an imminent danger to the United States. The vulnerability of the regime is an interesting question. First of all, it's not clear that attacking the regime in the way we have makes it more vulnerable or maybe mobilizes people to support the regime. But the second issue is, at least since Gerald Ford's presidency, there's legal statute that prohibits the president from assassinating foreign leaders. That's actually against the law. I think that's why the Israelis did it and not the United States military.
All right, help me with this most basic question. Are we at war? I mentioned earlier that I had had an interesting conversation with some kids in my car yesterday, and I didn't quite know how to navigate that. So is this war?
Yes. I think when you undertake military activities to overthrow a regime, it can only be war. I don't see any other way in which you can talk about that. Now, there are legal mechanisms that go into place when the United States declares war. particularly in terms of domestic behavior, the allocation of resources, the president's influence over the economy. Those are issues that might not legally be triggered because the United States has not declared war. But for all intents and purposes, when you announce on Truth Social that your goal is to overthrow a regime that has been in power for decades, that is an act of war under any common definition.
All right, then let's go to the next question. What about Congress's role?
Well, so under the War Powers Act, which was passed in the early 1970s, the president must brief and get approval from Congress within 60 days. We are obviously short of 60 days right now. We'll see what the president does. He has shown no evidence of a desire to go to Congress for this. So at the very least, there is an upcoming deadline. I understand that the White House will be briefing members of Congress, I believe, tomorrow. But at some level, Congress does need to approve. And at the most basic level, David, Congress has to approve the money that's going to this war.
There's been some attention focused on Reza Pahlavi, who was the son of the former Shah of Iran, who left Iran, I guess it was 47, 48 years ago, before the Islamic Revolution. Reza Pahlavi is positioning himself as a kind of a transitional figure, and it's perhaps worth noting that 47 years ago, Pahlavi was in Lubbock, I believe, training to be a jet fighter.
Yes.
Let's talk about who could take, plausibly, take over if the current government does, in fact, collapse. And there's some question about whether that will happen.
So this is probably the most important question, David. What happens next, right? War involves many stages, and bombing a country and perhaps overthrowing its regime, if that happens, that's only step one. What happens after that? Now, President Trump gave an interview to the New York Times where he said we had some designated people on the ground in Iran, obviously not Pahlavi, but that we killed them in the bombing. So it's not clear who on the ground we're looking to. Pahlavi, of course, sees himself as the natural successor once this regime is overthrown. But he's a very problematic figure. He has been out of the country, as you said, for 47, 48 years. And the historical record, David, is that when you try to bring back someone who has been outside of a country for that long, they lack legitimacy and they also lack an understanding of the country. This is a different Iran. Iran's population, more than 50% of it is under 30. So they're a post-revolution generation. He's not their man. It's hard to imagine him being an effective leader on the ground in Iran.
Right now, there are no boots on the ground. Is that going to change as you see it?
I fear it will. My concern is that we will see chaos within Iran, and we will see violence from within Iran going into other areas. Already, Iranian drones have hit targets in Dubai, in Abu Dhabi, in Bahrain, and that there will need to be American force on the ground to secure order and to secure any forces that are in Iran from not hitting our allies and our own bases in the region. And that's, of course, how we get involved in a long-term occupation. And I fear we're going in that direction.
Yesterday's attacks by Iran on some of its neighbors were widely condemned by Britain, France, Germany, among many others. And they seem to be, at least according to some commentary, standing orders in the event that there was some kind of decapitation or disruption. And it's not clear just how much command and control is in Iran right now. Do you see any hints of how much the government is actually in control there?
It's hard to say. There is an interim government. There is even a video of the three members of that interim government meeting. But I really don't know. As a historian, I will say in these conditions, you're likely to see a breakdown in command and control. But that makes the situation more volatile and dangerous because then you have pockets of resistance that are hard to manage. And even if the regime decides not to hit French and British assets in the region, who's to say a local commander won't decide to do that anyway?
It'll be interesting to see if President Trump has said that he has received questions about from Iranian government officials about whether talks could be restarted. A possibility, is that a way to bring this to at least a simmering quasi-conclusion for the short term?
Gosh, I hope so. That would be the best possible outcome, would be for this to end as quickly as possible with some kind of agreement. The problem is the Iranian government is now denying just what Trump said. And in fact, Mr. Lirjani, the national security advisor from Iran, who's been leading these talks, is quoted just this morning saying that he never reached out to the U.S. to reopen talks. So I don't know if that's the direction we're going. But the best way out of this is some kind of agreement, some face-saving agreement for both the U.S. and Iran that brings the bombing to an end. Otherwise, I feel we're in an escalation spiral, and this will be a long, long conflict. I should also mention, David, the United States is running short on munitions, and pretty soon we'll have to move munitions from East Asia and elsewhere. And that's not a good thing when China is threatening Taiwan. We have other concerns in the world, and I don't see how we benefit from a long conflict in Iran.
Jeremy Suri, historian, and Mack Brown Distinguished Chair in Leadership in Global Affairs, History, and Public Policy, University of Texas at Austin. Professor, thanks again.
Thank you.